Welcome to Translating Proteomics, where we explore the science of proteomics and its growing impact on basic biological research, drug development, and more. In this episode, we cover biology in space and time and specifically discuss biological systems as dynamic adaptive systems, how current experimental designs rarely take space and time into account, and the tools necessary to sufficiently measure biology in space and time. And now your hosts, Parag Malik and Andreas Humer of Nautilus Biotechnology.
Welcome back to Translating Proteomics. Today, we're talking about biology in space and time. And this is a topic that is incredibly dear to my heart. As a systems biologist, this is a topic we obsess over. And so, Andreas, I'm really curious to hear your perspectives on biology and space and time. And let's start off. Why do we care about space and time?
Well, because ultimately we all have to survive in space and time. and in fact, I think that's, you know, going back to the, you know, maybe incorrect perspective that biological systems can be viewed like mechanistic systems can, or like, you know,
yeah. Do you know where that comes from?
No.
So if we go way back in time, this is really interesting. So we go back to the roots of what a gene is. Mm-hmm. So in order to do that, we have to go back to 1909, Archibald Gurrow. And he was studying a genetic inherited disease called alkaptonuria, and which was related, as it turns out, to a single recessive gene. Mm-hmm. And if this gene was there, there was a deficiency in an enzyme and you had the disease. And so there was this single genetic perturbation independent of space and time. If you had it, you had the disease. If you didn't, you didn't. And that actually led to the original definition of a gene. And then later in the 1940s, Beadle and Tatum looking at Neurospora, same thing. There was a mutation in a gene that if it was one way or another, one gene, one enzyme, one phenotype, one output. And so there was no space and time. There was just, was there a genetic change or not? And that was implicit in the concept of a gene. A gene controlled all of function.
And that, as we know, is no longer correct for at least most of the non-genetic diseases, or, you know, for just survival on as an organism, right? It's not determined by a single gene or even genes in general.
Right. I mean, what we ultimately care about is we care about predicting outcome. We care about predicting how perturbations lead to different outcomes, how cells sense and respond to their environment, how organisms sense and respond to their environment. And it's not governed by one gene at one time point.
Okay. When I think about, you know, the topic of biology in space and time, I often think about the weather analogy, because you know, it's similar to...
You're going to have to explain that.
It's similar to, you know, the dynamic system we have in, the, you know, in biology. You know, weather phenomena, you know, are cyclical mm-hmm. in nature, right? We have yep. seasons, we, you know, but they're nevertheless never the same. They're similar, mm-hmm. but never the same. And I think biological systems are similar.
Yeah, so there's terminology to describe that. So that we often in the systems community will talk about complex adaptive systems versus memoryless systems. So a memoryless system doesn't matter what happened before. Whatever's happening is purely about right now. A complex adaptive system, on the other hand, what happened before governs what happens in the future. And so our bodies, you know, it matters that I had, you know, I hurt my knee when I was 7, and that led to inflammation building up, which then led to something 30 years later. We are not a memoryless system.
Yes, we are not. And I think that's very clear once you, you know, had an injury, as you just described, that, you know, this may bother you for the rest of your life, right? But it also tells you that, you know, simple fact that we are aging tells you that we are evolving and we are, you know, evolving in space and time, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the spatial aspect is particularly interesting because there's a lot of technologies being developed right now for spatial biology applications.
Yes.
And I think we're starting to, from those results, we're starting to really appreciate the dynamic nature of biological systems as we see how cells migrate, how cells are never really stagnant, how cells just morphologically change to adapt to certain things. So I think the spatial aspect of biology is starting to get really, really appreciated.
Yes.
I'm not sure the temporal aspects are equally well appreciated at this point.
So how can you say that? I mean, we've been looking at cell signaling for decades and saying, this kinase changes this kinase, which changes this kinase. There's a series of events that happen. Is that not the same thing?
Oh yeah, certainly. But I think that, if I would have to capture the temporal aspects of it, like you can capture, spatial aspects in high resolution, multiple, color images, I think we would have to make movies of the results we have in biology. I think then you would really capture the nonlinear nature of these events, over time. I think that's where we, simply don't have,
So let's talk about, if we're going to talk about space and time, we have to talk about the scale. So are we talking microseconds? Certainly protein folding is happening on that kind of time scale. Are we talking seconds, minutes, years?
Depends on what you're trying to observe. I mean, milliseconds is vicious.
Femtoseconds. I mean, proteins are folding on that time scale.
Yes, that's right. I would think, for the purpose of studying human diseases, if it's a metabolic disease, probably, hours and days. I think if it's a, structural related disease, probably over months and weeks, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe even years. These things are happening. We all wear some smart device these days to sort of observe over longer term. So I think you're right, temporal changes are being captured. I think they're just not part of a typical planning experiment that people do around proteins. I mean, you're right, people can do these kinase experiments, but they're typically not, related yet.
Yes. So I think this is where this framework of multi-scale biology becomes very helpful, because we have some events that are occurring on incredibly fast timescales that are coalescing to coarser grained views that are happening on slower timescales or in different places. So we might have proteins aggregating or proteins assembling. That happens very quickly. But in order for them to translate that, to change that into a functional attribute, you need enough of those events to occur.
Yeah, and I think you see that actually sort of being addressed when people talk about multi-omics, right? Where they're trying to capture these different time frames and measurements.
Yes.
I think the terminology multi-omics is probably not correct. I think we're still doing multiple omics type measurements where we just try to, capture different modalities and then sort of magically trying to match them up. Mm-hmm. I think we still don't do systematically measured multiple or multi-omics experiment at this point.
So why not?
I think...
Well, actually, before you answer why not, go back in time. Why didn't we do this 10, 15 years ago? And...
You're probably most familiar with that yourself in the computational tools are just weren't available 15 years ago. The analytical tools are just emerging where we can do highly multiplexed experiments where we can look at hundreds and maybe thousands or hundred thousands of events at the same time. I think the biggest issue still is that we don't actually have good mathematical models to deal with the data, even if we have them. In fact, we might have them, but we may not be able to actually get the data, to get the results out of the data that we have.
So, I mean, was there a particular customer that you worked with that was trying and failing to do these kinds of models, or trying and succeeding?
No, I think there were, an example that comes to my mind is there was a scientist studying a plant cycle, which is important for a particular crop that they were investigating. And so, they didn't make any progress with traditional biological measurement. There was a lack of antibodies for particular proteins of interest. There were lots of hurdles to do this in a traditional way. I think even the genome hadn't been done for that plant. So they thought, well, we'll just measure metabolomics and proteomics. And they did, and did an incredible amount of work. But then they realized after the fact, in fact, that was the conversation with me, the person said, well, do you have software that can bring these data sets together? And you know, it's like, well, we have, you know, formal ways to sort of read out the data and then maybe bring them together at the level of, let's say, a Go annotation. But really, there's no tool. And then it was kind of a shock for the person because they'd spent so much time acquiring all the data. Yeah. But I think that's basically where technology is today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I agree with you. I think when we look at what tools are available today, I think the systems biology community has done a really phenomenal job of building these network models. But still, where they've been most effective is in static representations of systems. When you start getting to dynamic systems and changes over time and changes that happen at different length scales, some things that happen fast and happen slow, I don't think we yet have the computational infrastructure to really ask those questions at scale.
And then beyond that, again, the question is how do you communicate it? I have often stood in front of posters. I'm pretty sure the same happened to you.
Yeah.
There's this complex hairball of connections between components of a cellular system. Mm-hmm. And you look at this and say, well, I know it's complicated, but I'm not sure what I can learn from this particular hairball that you show on this poster. So I think we need different ways to communicate it. And, you know, a best analogy I have is like, we need to make movies. Yeah. And so maybe instead of having a poster, there's a screen that shows an animation of the different ways that this biological system could be communicating, switching, evolving.
Yeah, so if we think about the future and the need, so it sounds like we have two related but different needs. We have one that is on the measurement side, because if you want to start making movies, a movie which you only have 5 frames of, not much of a movie.
No.
So, you know, we think about traditional movies being 60 frames per second.
Yeah.
And so if we wanted to describe biology, we need to sample the time landscape sufficiently to capture where the action's happening. And that might involve hundreds, thousands, millions of experiments. It's one side of the problem. The other side of the problem is if you handed someone millions of experiments and said, all right, build a model, build a computational framework to make sense of this, we don't have the analytical tools to deal with that kind of data.
So what comes first, the model or the data?
Both. I don't think you need to have all of, I think they evolve together because I think you need to have enough examples of what the data kind of looks like in order to build the infrastructure for analyzing it. There's a lot you can do with simulation, and I think there is a lot being done with simulation. So you can partially simulate the data to then predict what the analytical framework might need to be. But reality is never what the simulation shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So my feeling is that we will have to get more perspectives of a biological system to start to really tackle the dynamic nature of them. And again, I look at the weather phenomena, right? We have temperature measurements, we have, you know, cameras, we have satellites, we have, you know, measurements at different layers of the atmosphere. All of them ultimately allow us to predict this, you know, thing we call weather, right? And you know, pretty well actually these days. Yeah. On a local basis. I think if we do the same thing biological systems, mm-hmm. as you say, we need massive amounts of data.
Yeah.
Right. To make that movie, we need massive amounts of data feeding, you know, computer computational models. And I think if you can think of maybe not doing a whole cell at the beginning, but maybe doing sub functions of a cell.
Yeah, or
system,
just even one pathway.
Yeah, but pathway, I think, would be probably sufficiently informative that we start all thinking about these things very differently.
So I remember a study that we were doing as part of the Physical Sciences Oncology Centers. This was a National Cancer Institute project to bring a lot of physical science researchers together with cancer biologists to tackle problems like this. And working with Rich Bono's group to do some of these kinds of modeling, particularly between the transcriptome and the proteome. And it was a gargantuan effort to collect the data to build these models. But at the end of the day, we were able to marry them. And it was so exciting to see the movie where you could see this, you know, you would treat with a drug, initially very little would happen. We were looking at a system where it was drug sensitive and resistant. And there was this point in time where all of a sudden the system switched. It flipped from, you know, there was one transcription factor in the middle that in the responder cells, it changed color. It changed it changed behavior. And that was the differentiation. If you looked at any single time point, you wouldn't see that. You only saw it when you looked at the whole movie. And that moment of being able to, that was really the first data set I'd ever seen that had enough temporal resolution across transcriptome and proteome to really see handshakes between those ohms and really see how the time element played out.
And now imagine that for hundreds of regulatory networks, right? You have to capture at the right point in time so you don't miss that S-curve transition.
Yes.
That, I think, is really the challenge.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we look historically, there have been inflection points in our ability to do these kinds of studies. I think there is a certain scale where you have to measure enough things, transcripts or proteins. You need, you know, dozens of measurements before you can do that in a systematic, reproducible way. You can't construct these kinds of models. And I'd say, you know, maybe about 10 years ago, we finally reached that point where we had enough sophistication and rigor of transcriptome and proteome together and how to perform multi-omic experiments to really have that transition point to build these detailed models.
I would also say maybe the emerging activities around biobanks are, probably a positive step in that direction. Instead of just, doing a cross-sectional study,
yes,
we are starting to really probe, plasma samples over longer periods of time. And I think they're already sufficiently informative to show that we probably need more measurements in, for some of these diseases to really be able to capture the right time, a point in time where, where we might either be able to interfere with drugs or that we might, find better markers for it, right?
You know what this is reminding me of is actually a completely different domain. So if we think about, and we have a whole episode focused on AI, but if we think about the new set of AI tools, part of what they were facilitated by was having billions of images of cats and dogs. And so that we needed to curate that resource in having the data available. And that once we reached a point where we had that data stored and organized and labeled, we could then go build these amazingly powerful AI tools. And I think that's what you're describing by having these biobanks. That's the analog. And then the next step will be having all of the data measured on those biobanks. And so there are sort of two steps in that function.
So if I listen to our conversation, we pull the picture or we paint the picture of an incredibly complex, system, which might take, many, many lifetimes to actually complete in a single frame or even a small movie. What do you think the tools we might have in the future to sort of help us in that quest to make a movie?
So I think there are two things we need to recognize. That while the system itself has a large number of components, tens of thousands of proteins and transcripts and metabolites, and so just because the system has lots of components doesn't mean it doesn't follow simpler rules. And so we can, instead of focusing on each individual component and what this protein does at this time or that time, if we can extract those simple principles, that's something that allows us to explain a lot of the behavior in a compact way. And that's how much of physics investigation works, is finding these general principles that apply across complexity and simplify complexity. So I think that's number one, is focusing on learning those fundamental principles. And I think number two is these models that we're building, these systems, having ways to integrate them and click them together so that one lab can develop a model of this of X that takes it to this point. And another lab can build a model of Y that takes it to this point. And ultimately, we can click them together and build compound models that explain more and more and more exponentially so.
Clearly, you're describing a much more collaborative world in moving forward.
Well, I think this is the way we're going. I think if we look at the evolution of biosciences research, we started off in a world where data lived within one lab.
Yep.
And then we moved to a world where data was shared ubiquitously, and we have these repositories, things like the protein structure database, data bank, and the genome repositories, and SwissProt. And so that was the first layer, was just getting all the data into one place and everybody sharing openly. So the next evolution of that is workflows and processes. And the next evolution of that is models. And so I think it's just natural for us in the scientific community to evolve towards more interoperability, more community, more openness and reproducibility.
It sounds like a quest for making a movie of biology is really tractable at that point.
I think so. Yeah. But it's going to be a community effort, and we have to look at it as such.
Yeah, I agree.
We have had a wide-ranging conversation about biology and space and time, starting with the central thesis and moving to models and systems. So much fun. Thank you for joining us today.
We hope you enjoyed the Translating Proteomics podcast, brought to you by Nautilus Biotechnology. To contact us or for further information, please email translatingproteomics@nautilus.bio.